You're listening to the Judicial Watch weekly update with Tom Finn.
I'll open up with this: is the current crisis as it relates to the prosecutions, the political prosecutions of President Trump by the Biden administration, Democratic Party, and its allies in New York City and in most recently Fulton County, Georgia. Developments in that case or those cases include Judge Chutkan, who is the she's an Obama appointee judge, no friend of President Trump based on comments she's made from the bench previously in January 6 cases that she's handled. She set a trial for the sham prosecution of Trump for March 4th of 2024, which is a day before the Super Tuesday primaries. And as I've highlighted to you, this is a case about alleged election interference by President Trump, right? That he wanted to, quote, overturn the election by disputing the election, which, of course, is an Alice in Wonderland legal analysis run by political, being put out there by the political prosecutors in the Biden Justice Department. And so on top of that, the judge, rather than rejecting the desperate effort by the Biden administration to jail Trump next year, because they wanted this trial to begin in January, she said, oh, no, that's too soon. It's going to be 2 or 3 months later in March. Actually, literally 2 months later. And President Trump's lawyers had asked for the trial to begin in 2026. So it's clear that Judge Chutkan is accepted the Biden administration's and the Democratic Party's invitation to have the judiciary interfere with the elections next year. And of course, this snap trial that I think is really an abomination in terms of the president's rights to a fair trial is just on top of all the other abuses we're seeing. And it's bad enough to have the prosecutors abuse their powers, but when you see the judges ratify it and play along or pretend it's not happening, it's really destabilizing, I think, to our system of justice. It undermines confidence in the fair administration of justice. And for instance, in this case, you have tens of millions of documents, at least 12 million documents, last I checked, that need to be reviewed by Trump's lawyers to prepare for the trial. And of course, there are other witnesses and things like that. And of course, he has other indictments he's facing from allied, not only from the Justice Department, but from the prosecutors in New York and in Georgia. And Judge Chutkan actually said, well, you should have begun preparation when the grand jury was first called. So you're not indicted, you've not been accused of a crime, and you're supposed to be preparing for the defense? Well, that shows you that the grand jury process is corrupted if the judge thinks that you should just presume you're going to be indicted if a grand jury is called. But again, that's a more of an Alice in Wonderland legal analysis. You should be prepared for trial just because there's been a grand jury, and you should prepare your defenses over cases you have that have been filed against you, charges that haven't been specified against you. And he's punished for that with a snap trial. So whether the trial takes place or not, I think is still an open question, because part of this process, you go to trial, you start essentially, well, on that day in March of next year, March 4th, that's when the trial begins, in a sense, the jury selection begins. But what happens is the court kind of backs away from that date, and there are a series of briefs that are due in preparation for the trial, right? And some of those briefs could delay the trial significantly if they are appealed. The president's lawyers plan to assert immunity, raise First Amendment issues, selective prosecution issues, and who knows what else. And they may even object directly to the court about the snap nature of this trial. And this is on top of the desperate effort by the Fulton County to have a snap trial again in Georgia. So on top of that, they want a trial because one of the defendants of the, I think, 18 defendants wants a quick trial in October. And the response of the Fulton County, Georgia prosecutors said, well, everyone should be prosecuted or put on trial in October then. Of course, President Trump doesn't want to be face trial that soon because he needs more time to prepare any defense or, you know, any challenges he has to the prosecution. So I just want to I want you to imagine a snap trial of 18 defendants on unprecedented charges related to daring to dispute under the First Amendment, under the other constitutional provisions governing elections, under federal law governing elections, under your rights as a citizen and a candidate, in the case of the president, a president. And they're trying to jail nearly 24 people in one fell swoop in one trial. This shows you the contempt and the politicization of the system of justice there in Fulton County. We see it happening up here in Washington, D.C. And, you know, I don't know if they're going to seek recusal of Judge Chutkan. I don't know if there's enough for recusal. I know just because people think, well, she's appointed by Obama, therefore she has to recuse herself. Well, that's not the way it works necessarily. But she has said a few things from the bench that would make me think a recusal question should be raised, especially when she complained. I don't have the exact quote, but you can look it up. She essentially complained that Trump hadn't been arrested. She was sentencing or talking to another defendant or referencing a defendant in the January 6 prosecutions. And, you know, she basically bemoaned the fact that Trump wasn't prosecuted. Now, that suggests a certain bias that I think should be explored by Trump's lawyers, but we'll see. So it's a terrible time for the Republic still. I mean, it's being buffeted day by day, week by week, by these out-of-control prosecutors, these rogue prosecutors, these road prosecutions, and the courts don't seem terribly interested in reining it in too much, based at least on what's happened thus far up here in Washington, D.C. And what is Congress doing about it? No, don't worry. They are still on vacation. As I said to you before, they are on a seven-week recess, and they won't be back till September 12th. So you get Labor Day off. I'm sure most of you will be getting Labor Day off, and those of you who are working, thank you for working. But Congress has a seven-week recess, and if McCarthy, Speaker McCarthy, were serious about dealing with the current crisis, he would have called Congress back. He would have called the House back weeks ago. I was in a meeting the other day, and I said, well, how about calling Congress back, the House back, just a day early? Just pretend you take these issues seriously. We're running up on by the way, there's a September 30th deadline on this big spending fight, right? They're supposed to have all their ducks in a row with regard to appropriations by September 30th. Otherwise, they got to pass a continuing resolution, you know, that fiscal cliff, supposedly. And they're coming back on the 12th. And on top of that, we have these outrageous prosecutions and election interference and abuse of power by the Justice Department and Fulton County in New York, all of which can be stopped by congressional action in the context of that spending fight I just told you about. And then we have the ongoing crisis with President Biden's corruption, which McCarthy is trying to dance around. He keeps on saying, well, you know, we're getting close to an impeachment inquiry, but he doesn't want an impeachment inquiry. Otherwise, we'd have one by now. He'd call Congress back. So if you are interested in having Congress do the work and do the heavy lifting that's necessary to stop this corruption, because they know what's happened. You know, so are they going to keep on funding it or not? Okay? This is where the rubber meets the road over the next 6 weeks. Are they going to keep on funding it or not? Now, the establishment will say, you can't not fund the government, right? You have to fund the government. Doesn't matter what you're spending the money on, it just has the spice must flow, to quote the great book Dune. We've got to keep the money flowing. So if you've got concerns about the FBI being funded to target Americans and harass Americans, you've got concerns about the Justice Department interfering in our elections or obstructing justice to help Hunter, if you're concerned about agencies of the Biden administration censoring Americans, that has to be funded. If you're concerned about military academies telling their students, their cadets, their midshipmen, that America is racist and we have to support Marxist critical race theory, that has to be funded. If you support this crazed prosecution in Fulton County or up in New York City against Trump, where they're trying to jail him for doing his job as president, literally, that has to be funded. Federal monies have to flow to Fulton County. There can be no cutoff. They're essentially going to be ratifying it unless they do something about it. Now, there are some congressmen who are going to be submitting appropriations bills. I think Congressman Clyde and Congressman Biggs and a few others, Congressman Gates, they've talked about doing this. So these are all opportunities for accountability and not only that, but it actually could fix some of the misconduct and stop it. So it's all coming up. So you got to talk to your members of Congress and let them know what you think, because you know what the establishment media is going to say, what the left media is going to say, what the establishment Republicans are going to say. Mitch McConnell, I know, who has health issues. I disagree with him on a lot of stuff. I agree with him on other things, but he doesn't want to do impeachment. You know, that crowd over there doesn't want to do impeachment or anything related to accountability. And as I said, if McCarthy wanted to do something on impeachment, he already would have done something on impeachment. And to keep you updated, as I told you a few weeks ago, we're still trying to get the January 6th videos out of Congress, right? And we've sued the Capitol Hill Police Department. And I want to tell you how frustrating it was 2 weeks ago when we were in court on a hearing related to this case. Was this case's hearing? We were seeking the videos, and it's me, our lawyer Michael Bekesha. We're in federal court before the judge, and at the other table are the attorneys for the Biden Justice Department, along with an attorney for the U.S. Capitol Hill Police. So essentially, that's the McCarthy Congress, right? Being represented by the Biden administration's Justice Department as they try to stop the January 6th videos from being designated public records and being widely released to the American people. So right now we are battling Speaker McCarthy's Congress and the Biden administration on this core transparency issue about January 6th. So I know sometimes McCarthy does the right thing, but I tell you, when you're on the wrong side of transparency, when you're on the wrong side of government accountability, Judicial Watch is going to call you out. And we are nonpartisan, Republicans and Democrats. Both need to be held accountable to the rule of law, and they just can't let the corruption go by as if no one's being impacted and our system isn't being broken by it. So we've got litigation on all of these issues, as I said. For instance, this week, our friends at the Southeastern Legal Foundation, which is a conservative legal group that's been around a long, long time. I know they were around before even Judicial Watch was created nearly 30 years ago. They've had litigation. They just sued the National Archives for, I don't know exactly what, but essentially in that litigation, they've uncovered through their initial FOIA that they've got 5,400 emails or so responsive to their request about what are they asking for? the alias emails of Joe Biden, you know, Robin Ware and Peters and such, right? So there, I think there are at least three email accounts, maybe as many as six. So they sued, you know, because they've been taking forever and a day to turn these documents over. They haven't turned any of the documents over. It's been 14 months. The Biden Archives, which is colluding with the Justice Department to jail Trump over a documents dispute that had never been criminally prosecuted similarly by any Justice Department or pushed in any aggressive way by any prior against any other former president, is right now hiding records about Joe Biden's secret email accounts, his alias email accounts. And Judicial Watch has litigation against the archives as well for, that's been, we filed back in May for Joe Biden's documents about Joe Biden's business arrangements with Hunter, et cetera, et cetera. So all the email communications. And we made it clear to them this week that they better be searching these alias email accounts or searching those documents. But it shows you this gamesmanship that goes on, because if no one knew about these email accounts, you wouldn't know to set to kind of put the focus and the onus on the archives to get these records out. Because we wouldn't say, we wouldn't know to search for this specific email account, right? And now Congress is getting in the on the game, and they've either have a subpoena or a letter out. I don't know what they're going to do. But all I can tell you is they need to do more, because I know Congress, at least the House, they've been doing a lot. It's necessary what they've done, but it's not sufficient. We need to move into the impeachment phase of these on these very issues and move more quickly for accountability. As I call it, the punishment phase for the corruption that's already been uncovered and that's just sitting there in plain sight. And so Judicial Watch is ratcheting up the pressure on the Biden archives for documents that they are hiding about Biden corruption. We're doing it not only in that major lawsuit we filed for basically information on the whole Clinton, the whole Biden family corruption issue. That's a Freudian slip, because they're kind of two peas of the same pod, aren't they? By the way, if you want to know why they didn't want to do anything on Hillary Clinton's secret email accounts, well, it's because people like Joe Biden had three or four secret email accounts. It tells you something, doesn't it? So we're pushing hard on all of this. And more directly, we're in litigation against the FBI for records on that Hunter Biden gun scandal. And we've talked about this before in the update. I hope you've seen my previous updates on this, or at least looked at our material online. And on that case specifically was about this issue where Hunter was messing around with his dead brother's widow. And she got mad at him and took a gun and threw it in a, took his gun and threw it in a dumpster in Delaware near a school or a grocery place or something like that. And the reports by Politico and The Blaze was that the Secret Service leapt into action and that the FBI leapt into action to go evidently and vacuum up documents from the place where Hunter purchased the gun. So we sued for records of the Secret Service on that. They gave us some documents suggesting that the FBI was involved and the Secret Service may have been involved. So we expanded our lawsuit to include the FBI. We filed a new lawsuit. And I think we had filed the request in January earlier this year. And then we filed the lawsuit a little bit later. And the FBI just told us that, you know, they've got a bunch of documents, but they can't give them to us because they're exempt because of an ongoing criminal investigation. And they cite the special counsel, the sham special counsel that was just instituted by the Garland Justice Department, that special counsel Weiss, who was caught with a shady plea deal trying to give Hunter a pass on a gun charge issue where he allegedly falsified a document in registering for the gun and filling out the federal background check form. Now, what is the ongoing investigation is what I'd like to know. Are they investigating the FBI for intervening improperly in this case to help Hunter? Are they intervening? Are they investigating the Secret Service? Who was involved in helping Hunter here? Are they investigating Joe? No. This is all an excuse to hide records that are inconvenient, because these records we began asking for in January, long before there was a special counsel investigation. So what happens is we file a lawsuit and you begin talking to the government and say, "Yeah, look, can we get documents?" And if you can't agree on documents, you go to the court about the timeline. And you file what is what they call a joint status report, where the plaintiff, Judicial Watch, and the defendant, in this case the Justice Department, when you sue the FBI, you sue the Justice Department. Despite what the FBI would have you believe, they actually are a division of the Justice Department, and they report to the Justice Department. They're not their own little kingdom, Director Wray. You still report to the Attorney General and to the President. And we had asked for all records, including investigative reports, telephone logs, witness statements, memoranda, and firearm purchase documentation related to the reported purchase, possession, and disposal of a firearm owned by Hunter Biden discarded in a Delaware trash receptacle circa October 2018. All records of communications of FBI officials regarding the reported purchase, possession, and disposal of the firearm. So we weren't asking about the form he filled out. I guess in theory that could be responsive. We want to know about that incident, right? And they know we know. They know what we want. And instead, the FBI responds as follows. It claims it completed a search for records responsive to our request, but alleges an unspecified number, they don't want to tell us the number, are exempt from disclosure due to, quote, an ongoing criminal investigation. And this is what they say specifically. FBI has completed a search for records responsive to Judicial Watch's request and is currently processing those records. FBI's position is that the number of potentially responsive records is exempt from disclosure under FOIA Exemption 7A, which is that criminal case exemption, essentially ongoing law enforcement investigation, allows them to withhold documents if the documents touch on that or a part of that, as this case relates to an ongoing criminal investigation. And they cite the law that says FOIA does not apply to information where disclosure, quote, could reasonably be expected to interfere with enforcement proceedings. And they say, see also U.S. Attorney's Office, District of Delaware, tax and firearms charges filed against Robert Hunter Biden. So they're basically referring back to the sham charges that Weiss ginned up with the Biden gang to keep Hunter out of jail as an excuse not to give us the documents. An ongoing investigation creates the need for increased internal review. So these documents we asked for in January, oh no, now there's a special counsel. We need increased internal review, including in this case, review by the special counsel. So now the special counsel is officially part of Judicial Watch's FOIA lawsuit for documents that, about an incident essentially from 2018 that we've already litigated and gotten documents separately from the Secret Service on, but now the FBI can't give us much of anything because they're using this sham special counsel investigation as an excuse. And in their defense, they say, well, this isn't even a significant public case because Judicial Watch wasn't asking for expedited consideration, which is just so silly legally. We don't need to ask for, quote, invoke magic words of expedited consideration when we file a FOIA. They're supposed to respond within a certain period of time, essentially a month. It's now 10 months. Judicial Watch argues the Biden FBI is withholding information about the number of documents, as I said, they are hiding and whether any records will ultimately be released. This case is indisputably of significant public interest. It is also time sensitive. Judicial Watch has asked and defended has refused to provide the number of potentially responsive records that need to be processed in this case. They don't even want to tell us how many records they're looking at. That's how corrupted this is. Without this number, plaintiffs can't evaluate, let alone agree to a processing time of 120 days. So they're asking for months. Because this case could proceed down several different paths, Judicial Watch believes this case may benefit from a status conference at this juncture. Well, thankfully, the court agrees and set a hearing for next week, September 6th, here in D.C., a status conference. My quote in the case was, "The FBI continues to stonewall on its reported cleanup operation to shield Hunter Biden from facing the criminal consequences of his gun scandal, this time using the compromised special counsel investigation of Hunter as a new excuse to hide records that we asked for back in January." So, in February of 2023, we had gotten records or released records from the Secret Service, as I said earlier, that showed that when Politico was asking questions of the Secret Service, were you involved in vacuuming up documents, as our sources are reporting, the Secret Service was A, suggesting they didn't know if that was the case, and then when they were seeking clarification, the Politico reporter was seeking clarification from the Secret Service, they basically ignored the follow-up questions, which means they had more to tell and they didn't want to tell the reporter about their role with Hunter Biden. And I don't even think Hunter Biden was being protected by the Secret Service when he had this gun taken from him by his then girlfriend, or I don't know what she was. This is what Politico reported. Actually, in October 2020, The Blaze reported that in October 2018, Hunter Biden's handgun was taken by Haley Biden, the widow of then presidential nominee Joe Biden's son, Beau. In 2021, Politico reported, Haley took Hunter's gun and threw it in a trash can behind a grocery store, only to return later to find it gone. Delaware police began investigating, concerned that the trash can was across from a high school and that the missing gun could be used in a crime, according to law enforcement officials in a copy of the police report obtained by Politico. But a curious thing happened at the time. Secret Service agents approached the owner of the store where Hunter bought the gun and asked to take the paperwork involving the sale, according to two people, one of whom has firsthand knowledge of the episode, and then the other was briefed by a Secret Service agent after the fact. So, the other document shows that the Secret Service had the reporter said the FBI also had some involvement in the investigation. So that's why we want the FBI's knowledge of what went on here and documents about it. Judicial Watch has at least 10 federal lawsuits on Biden family corruption. At least 10. And that's kind of a narrow definition of Biden family corruption. I would argue it's probably double that. I mean, we just sued, you may recall, the CIA about its role in the election interference in 2020 in proving quickly and then asking people to sign that false letter alleging that the Hunter Biden laptop story was Russia disinformation. We've just sued for records about the obstructed IRS investigation of Hunter Biden as detailed by IRS whistleblowers. We sued for that infamous FBI document that was buried in 2020 showing that the Burisma CEO told a key FBI source that he gave 5 million dollars in bribes to Hunter, $5 million in bribes to Joe, $10 million total as part of a bribery extortion scheme that protect Burisma, and so on and so forth. And I told you about the National Archives cases we have. We have a case against the State Department that we've pursued. Just great stuff. So despite all the work that Congress is doing, dare I say it, Judicial Watch is doing more. And in some cases, we're likely to get documents, and this has been the case in the past, before Congress does. And we want Congress to keep on asking for documents, but, you know, this is people, members of Congress ask me this. They say, Tom, why is it Judicial Watch can get documents Congress can't? And it's because it's a political process when Congress asks an administration for documents. Now, I know the law applies to the handling of those documents, and Congress has its prerogatives in going to court to get documents, but that rarely happens, and when it does, it's kind of a big rigmarole because of the political nature of the litigation. The courts don't like to and are careful about adjudicating fights between the executive branch and Congress because, you know, sometimes it's more political than legal. But under FOIA, it's more of a straightforward legal process. The Freedom of Information Act, if the agencies don't respond within a certain period of time or they don't give you the documents you think you deserve under law, you can go to federal court and the clock starts ticking. Now, it never moves as quickly as we would like, but the process just, it's like a train. It leaves the station and it's difficult to derail unless either the documents are produced or they explain to the court why it is they are withholding whatever they are seeking to withhold. And so we end up just getting documents that Congress is still fighting about. Or, as importantly, and this is a more interesting side of it. It depends on who you ask and when you ask. So I could ask, or Judicial Watch could ask, give us all documents about Hunter Biden's talks with Joe Biden at the State Department, right? And there's an office at the State Department, the FOIA office, that looks for the documents and sends out a request to agency personnel, do a search. You know, at least that's the way it often happens or is supposed to happen. So when Congress asks for records from the State Department, the same request, it goes to a different office, the Office of Legislative Affairs. Now, I'm exaggerating. You know, there are obviously some permutations there I'm not getting into. But essentially, it's a different group of people who handle the request, a different group of people who conduct the search and manage the response. So that we may get a document that Congress doesn't get, and Congress may get a document we don't get. And that's why you need, in addition to Congress asking questions, Judicial Watch asking questions, and of course I love it when the media asks questions, and like Southeastern Legal Foundation is asking questions about Hunter's emails or Joe's secret email accounts, the more the better when it comes to government transparency. This government is gargantuan. Judicial Watch is America's leading government watchdog when it comes to the Freedom of Information Act. We have thousands and thousands of FOIA requests, probably at least 1,000 FOIA lawsuits by this time, certainly in the high hundreds. And that's only scratches the surface of everything that can and should be asked for about what the government's up to. So the more, the better. So that's my educational take on FOIA and what and how it intersects with Congress. But Congress can get these documents if they chose to using political power or constitutional prerogatives, right? With spending power and other threats under subpoena. You know, it used to be back in the day that Congress could find someone in contempt and the Congress could hold the person in contempt and put them in a jail up on Capitol Hill. They don't do that anymore. Instead, they've outsourced all that to the Justice Department, which means the Justice Department controlled by a party that's hostile to their interests, or maybe even the same party that's hostile to their interests, you know, isn't going to pursue civil contempt proceedings or criminal contempt proceedings against individuals, certainly in an administration, that withhold documents. So that's another thing that Congress can do, but they don't want to do. So there you go. So this hearing is next week, September 6th, on this FBI case. We've got the special counsel involved. They're being used as an excuse to hide documents, which was predicted, by the way. Because remember, Garland resisted and refused corruptly to appoint a special counsel, and there was an issue about whether Weiss wanted to be a special counsel, whether he was denied, and then he came up with this sweetheart plea deal, and they said, oh, we'll just make Weiss a special counsel and pretend all the corruption involved there that he's been implicated in, his office has been implicated in, that will all be washed away. And many people on the Hill said, well, now, you know, it's going to be harder to get him to testify, and they're going to use the fact that there's ongoing investigations to justify withholding documents. Sure enough, that's just exactly what they did in this key Judicial Watch case about the FBI and the Secret Service rushing to protect Hunter Biden from the consequences of his crazed actions up in Delaware with that crazy gun issue with his wife, his girlfriend or friend, throwing the gun in the trash. And I don't even know if there was like a criminal aspect to that happening. You know, I don't know. You know, someone mishandled a gun. Is there a crime there? I don't know. But certainly the Secret Service got nervous, or the FBI got nervous. Politico got word that something happened. Blaze got word something happened. And certainly we know something happened, or we can fairly conclude something happened, because the FBI is, contrary to law and good sense and ethics, withholding information about the case. Out of control. So, many have highlighted the disparate treatment between BLM rioters and Antifa rioters in 2020, where they tried to kill President Trump, victimized cities across America, targeted the federal officials for killing and assault, tried to burn buildings with people in them down. Little federal 200 prosecutions. I think last I checked, there were 300 prosecutions of those BLM riots in 2020 that tore the country apart. Compare and contrast with the Justice Department's, Biden Justice Department's political prosecutions of the January 6th disturbance. I think it's now 1,100, 1,300, doesn't matter. It's well over 1,000 prosecutions, some of which have these outlandish, in my view, over-the-top charges. When you compare and contrast other political slash riots that have taken place in the past. For instance, when I went to the Kavanaugh hearings, there was all sorts of violence and intimidation. Certainly by their definition, the left's definition, insurrection, an effort to overturn democracy and trying to stop the Kavanaugh nomination by the left. Certainly nothing similar was done against the groups involved there. They're not facing jail for 15, 17, 18 years like some of these other individuals are. And in the course of our investigation and lawsuit for documents about the needless shooting death of Ashley Babbitt by Lieutenant Byrd, who's now going to be promoted to a captain outrageously, Ashley Babbitt, Lieutenant Byrd essentially popped out from behind a column, shot into a crowd, and killed Ashley Babbitt. No good reason for that shooting. He's given a free pass and special protection by both the Capitol Police, the District of Columbia Police, and the Justice Department. So we've had a lot of litigation to get documents about what happened there, expose a lot what went on. But in the course of that litigation, we received documents about how the Justice Department responded to the January 6th disturbance. And you can see in the documents, it was an unprecedented apparatus that was set up as part of, it looks to me like a political purge of Trump supporters. So this was a lawsuit that we filed for against the Justice Department and the FBI for records related to the death of Ashley Babbitt. And we got back a bunch of documents, 90 pages of records, from the Office of United States Attorneys. And that there's a chart there dated January 25th, 2021, so shortly after Bush came into office and a few weeks after the riots. And this is what their tasks are. This is the kind of the orientation of what they were supposed to be doing. To identify and prosecute the individuals and organizations responsible for planting pipe bombs at the DNC and RNC. We still don't know what happened there. To identify and prosecute rioting activity in the Speaker's lobby, and in particular determine whether there is civilian criminal culpability for the death of Ashley Babbitt. So they weren't looking at, well, they were looking at the police involvement in that death. But they were also interested in trying to prosecute other people around Ashley Babbitt for Byrd shooting her. To identify and prosecute rioters responsible for the death of U.S. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick. Of course, the rioters weren't responsible for his death. It was readily apparent at the time. They all knew it at the time based on information we have or should have known it. But that's what they were trying to do because he died the day after of natural causes. To review force allegations against U.S. Capitol Police and Metropolitan Police Department officers, including the officer involved shooting of Ashley Babbitt. So they were supposed to be looking at all of those issues, right? There was a riot. They're looking at prosecuting people involved in the rioting. But they were also supposed to be looking at the police if they committed misconduct. And, you know, an honest evaluation of January 6th would lead to a much more, dare I say it, nuanced analysis of what happened that day. You had lack of security that, in my view, encouraged and allowed violence to take place. You had ill-trained and ill-prepared and not a big enough police force to deal with the crowd that led to an overreaction by the police department in terms of anti-crowd control measures that incited the crowd in part. Does it absolve everyone in that crowd from engaging in violence and assault? No, of course not. But an aspect of the January 6th riot was that the U.S. Capitol Police and other law enforcement personnel who were stuck up there trying to protect the Capitol help incite the crowd because they were throwing gas into the crowd and doing all those sorts of things that really didn't do anything other than rile the crowd up. Now, this, again, the left would like to think, make you think if, well, Tom Fitton says that, he's justifying the right. No, I'm not justifying the right. I'm just calling it as I see it. And adults need to analyze how it is that riot happened. And it's been politicized, and they all just want to blame Trump, and they just want to put Trump supporters in jail and in an unprecedented fashion start applying federal law to this disturbance in a way that's seeing people go to jail and be in jail in a way that's never happened before in American history. And it's all political. Or much of it is political. And it's so politicized you can't even tell which is what would have been a normal prosecution and an appropriate prosecution versus an inappropriate prosecution. That's how bad it is. And then they talk about rapid indictments of January 6th defendants. Does that sound fair to you? Rapid indictments? That sounds like an MSNBC way of approaching indictments, not a law enforcement Department of Justice fair application of the law way. Phase one, command center. Cold Lake, this is part of the rapid indictment chart section. Co-located prosecutors and law enforcement agents in the command center screen referrals and assign them to phase two or refer them, push up intelligence to branches one and two. Phase two, complaints. Cases referred from phase one are assigned to AUSAs, a civil trial section attorney, and a Washington field office team who would work in coordination with the assistant U.S. attorney FBI field offices throughout the country to obtain criminal complaints and appropriate process. Phase three, rapid indictment. Cases charged out of Branch 3 are funneled to this unit, which will rapidly indict them. And then indicted cases are returned, assigned for prosecution. Cases essentially track with ticklers for Speedy Trial Act discovery, intelligence gathering. And this is another disturbing part. Branch 4 has both litigation and technological responsibilities. Mass data collection. This team will coordinate and handle sensitive search warrants and other process directed at collecting large-scale data. Geofence ad tech. So geofencing is basically getting all the phone data for a certain area. Media issues. The team will coordinate evidence collection from the media under the Justice Manual and develop litigation strategy for media-related defenses. So they're going to target the media. First Amendment issues, etc. There's a litigation and technology support apparatus lays out the array of technological sources to be used against the January 6th defendants. The chart lists categories of data, which include cell phone records, device location data, cell phone data dumps, and ad tech company location data, financial locational data, social media accounts, email accounts, cloud storage accounts, financial records, flight travel records, and others. You know, Judicial Watch was second to none in uncovering what was happening with the investigations of 9/11. And I want to tell you something. The FBI still wasn't able to figure out who helped pay and how the 9/11 hijackers were funded prior to that attack. And when we highlighted that this was the issue, the FBI kind of admitted it to the media. Yeah, we still don't know all the details. And I tell you, if they had devoted the resources that they devoted to January 6th to 9/11, there'd be dozens of more people arrested and terrorist networks rolled up. And I'm quite confident, because we work with people who investigated terrorism at the time, that if they had these resources available to them about known terrorist operators at the time, 9/11 would never have happened. But this is a decision by the Justice Department to deploy resources that have never been deployed against American citizens over a political riot, right? And it treats citizens as terrorists. These documents detail a troubling and unprecedented deployment of federal resources to prosecute Americans caught up in the January 6th disturbance. The documents seem to describe a massive political and spy operation masquerading as a law enforcement operation. So don't take my word for it. Go to the U.S. attorney sites. Go to the Justice Department's website. Google what Garland has said, what Wray has said, what the Biden administration has said about the depth and breadth of their investigation of January 6th. And I dare you to find anything comparable in American history in terms of deployment of resources. They say there is nothing like it in history. They don't have anything bigger than this. And it's scary, because what it means is that people who committed, quote, misdemeanors are being treated like terrorists. But the left can do whatever they want in terms of civil disturbances, breaking the law, burning buildings down, and there's no similar response by the deep state. In the meantime, we can't get a second of video from this Congress about what happened that day, as I said earlier. Because the Pelosi Congress, excuse me, it's the McCarthy Congress now, refuses to turn over 1 second of the videos. They want to designate them all as security videos, and no one can see them. Not 1 second. Yeah, I know they've made videos available separately to journalists and others. But that doesn't make all the videos available or all the videos that should be available under law. That's just stuff that is being made available under the discretion of the speaker. But the legal position in court is none of it can be made available, and you have no avenue in court to make them available. It's unbridled secrecy. At the same time, they're prosecuting people like it's, as they say, the worst day in American history. So they want to have it both ways, right? Deploy resources never seen before in American history while hiding key information about what happened that day. Not only videos, but emails about why there wasn't security, where was the security, who was responsible for that. Unbelievable. So I encourage you to look at those documents, because the media, they're not going to tell you about what the FBI was up to and how they were spying on Americans to try to get them indicted. But Judicial Watch separately have been trying to get the FBI to give us documents about them getting the banking data on everyone who was in Washington, D.C. And, of course, the courts here, who have enabled the Justice Department's crazed prosecutions and investigations of January 6th individuals, they've given them a pass on having to give us this basic information. So in my view, this is a failure both of the courts and of our Justice Department. This January 6th prosecution, the whole mania around it is going to be seen as a black mark on the history of justice in America, in the least. This chair is creaking. I don't know if you can hear it, but I can hear it, and it's driving me crazy. I think I got to lose some weight. I think I broke the chair. So, what I love about Judicial Watch is if there's a major issue, we almost always are second to none in trying to figure out the truth about it. And that obviously goes for the COVID scandal. And the COVID scandal is so broad and it's been so damaging to America and to other places in the world, I think we can't do enough to investigate it. And one of the things we've done is investigated the creation and the management and the promotion of the COVID vaccines, which, as you know, are controversial. And one of the things we found is that they didn't want to tell us basic information about adverse events and issues they were finding when they were testing the vaccines. We got information about that out, and other things that I think Americans would have been very interested in knowing before they were forced in too many instances to take the vaccines. And on top of all of that, then even once it became clear the vaccines weren't doing what everyone was told they were going to be doing, they started pushing boosters, a third booster, a fourth booster, a fifth booster. Now I think was this the sixth booster they're going to be planning and pushing for this fall and winter? I don't know. And so you would think when we have this important medical development with these vaccines, even giving them the benefit of the doubt they don't deserve, there would be substantial studies behind them showing their safety and efficacy. And Judicial Watch has shown that's really not the case. And specifically, we have new records that show that there was only a 23-person study done of a COVID vaccine safety, in a COVID vaccine safety study, before it was approved by the Biden administration. We got 58 pages of records. These are what the records look like. So we get the documents to come in. Investigational new drug application, right? And you get, it's filled out, and letters are sent, and the studies are attached. And here's the study. I don't know if you can see it, but anyway, we'll pop it up. And they've got all the charts and everything. It's all based on 23 people. They gave the booster to 23 people. Well, they wanted to give it to 24, but one of the people said, "I'm not taking a third shot, thank you." Now, I don't know about you. Does a study of 23 people and analyzing how they handled the vaccine booster over a month, is that enough to reassure you the booster was safe and effective and useful to take? I don't know. Maybe it is enough for you. But wouldn't you have liked to know that it was a 23-person study that was key behind the recommendation to provide the booster to, I think within a few months, 8.6 million people got it? I don't think so, but people have different views. This is what I love about also about Judicial Watch. We put the documents out there. I'll give you my take on them, but you can look at them and have your own take. But the best thing is that you can look at them, and you wouldn't be able to look for Adam but for Judicial Watch. So we had sued for records submitted by Pfizer and BioNTech to the FDA, including BARDA, related to booster vaccinations for the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So this law, BARDA is the Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority, and it's been heavily involved in the development of the COVID-19 vaccine. The authority provides an integrated, systematic approach to the development of necessary vaccines, drugs, and therapies, and diagnostic tools for public health, medical emergencies such as chemical, biological, radiological, neurological, and nuclear accidents, incidents, and attacks, pandemic influenza, and emerging infectious diseases. And BioNTech is the German pharmaceutical company that partnered with Pfizer in developing their original vaccine. So the documents we obtained include a July 2021 study titled Phase 1 Booster Safety and Immunogenicity Data Up to 1 Month Post Dose 3 of the study, and they give us all the numbers related to the study. The submission includes, and this is a quote, it's a group of people that had received 2 vaccine shots and 7 to 9 months later, the third booster shot. So they're testing the safety and efficacy of the third booster. And as you can see there on the screen, the submission includes preliminary findings from a subset of younger, 18 to 55 years of age, and older, 65 to 85 years of age, participants in the phase 1 part of study, you can see CXXXXXX, who completed the initial 2-dose series of the COVID vaccine, given approximately 3 weeks apart, and then received a third dose booster of the vaccine approximately 7 to 9 months after the second dose. Data were collected through the cutoff date of May 2021. So this was study was done in the spring of 2021. The participants were evaluated for symptoms for up to 1 month after the booster shot. The booster's immunogenicity on or how well a vaccine works over time was evaluated 7 days and 1 month after the booster. The participants included 11 people age 15 to 55 and 12 people age 65 to 85. Of the younger group, there were 9 females and 2 males, 8 of whom were white, 1 was black, and 2 were Asian. Of the older group, 6 were females, 6 were males, and all were white. The study reports that a booster dose increases the breadth of the neutralizing response against SARS-CoV variants, and that the data suggests that a third dose could prolong protection and further increase the breadth of protection. And the Pfizer study was sent to Marion Gruber, director of the Office of Vaccines Research and Review. So one of the big issues, and these were people who supported the initial vaccines, especially within the FDA, they thought, you know, these initial vaccines, we don't have real information that they're not effective against the boost, against the variants. So why are we fighting? Or why are we pushing for another booster? I mean, is it even needed? And sure enough, shortly after this was submitted, these studies, I guess there were 2 studies submitted, the White House in August, it said it was moving aggressively to roll out the booster shots. and despite yet not having even received clearance from the FDA. And then we found out that Gruber, who had received these documents, as Dr. Gruber and his deputy, because this is where he was the one who received the studies, were leaving the agency because they were frustrated with the CDC and Biden White House interference on vaccine decisions. They were among a group of resigning doctors who agreed that available evidence doesn't yet indicate a need for COVID-19 vaccine booster shots among the general population. The FDA said it based its decision on the documents presented by Pfizer, as well as input from the CDC, the Israeli Ministry of Health, and the University of Bristol in UK. And as I said, 3 weeks after the approval, it wasn't 8.3, it was 8.9 million boosters had been administered. With the planned push for new boosters by the Biden administration, the public would do well to examine these troubling documents about the shotgun approval of private COVID boosters. Now, Judicial Watch has a number of Freedom of Information Act lawsuits and ongoing FOIA investigations on this issue. And we've talked about how they've hidden adverse events that we have uncovered. For instance, rats were showing, having fetal rats were having wavy ribs, which could be an issue. How the lipid nanoparticles were residing in organs that they told us it really wouldn't be an issue with. All sorts of corruption there. Corruption in how we exposed how the Biden administration, how the Fauci agency was funding coronavirus mutant research in China, et cetera, et cetera. But here we now have, as we said earlier, the Biden administration pushing another booster, and you can bet the basis for this other booster is as weak as we're seeing with the prior booster that led senior health officials to resign over once Biden started to push it. And again, it's Judicial Watch doing the heavy lifting on this important public health issue and exposing that the government, when recommending and spending money on COVID vaccines, really didn't do their due diligence by any measure. And where would we be without Judicial Watch on this? We'd be in the dark, and dare I say it, some people would be a lot worse off health-wise without our warning folks about what the CDC and FDA have been hiding from us about these COVID vaccines. So as you can see, there's a lot going on at Judicial Watch. I encourage you to go to our website and look at these materials directly. Share the wealth, as I call it. These are great educational value to other Americans about what their government's up to. Judicial Watch can only do this with your support. If you like what you're hearing, I encourage you to support our work at judicialwatch.org, not only by sharing the wealth, as I say, in terms of the materials we've uncovered, but also supporting our work directly. And with that, I wish you a wonderful holiday, happy Labor Day, and I'll see you here next time on the Judicial Watch Weekly Update.
Thanks for listening to the Judicial Watch Weekly Update with Tom Fitton. For more information, visit www.judicialwatch.org, because no one is above the law.